Teaching is our passion. We at The Wall Street Skinny are proud to announce that we've joined the advisory board for the iConnections Funds for Teachers initiative, focused on supporting the Ron Clark Academy and its pioneering teaching methods. Through Funds for Teachers, iConnections is dedicated to empowering educators nationwide by providing access to RCA's professional development opportunities. Events are being organized in major cities throughout the year to fundraise and support this incredibly important cause. All proceeds from these events will be directly donated to the Ron Clark Academy, specifically to financially aid teachers so they can participate in RCA's groundbreaking training programs. Please click on the link in our show notes to register for an event in the city nearest you.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to The Wall Street Skinny with Kristen and Jen. I'm Kristen.
I'm Jen.
And today is our second installment in this weekly series that we just rolled out last week that is going to give you the skinny on what is moving the markets. So this week, we have a few things going on. So first, we had CPI numbers come out, which has actually been like a huge deal, which Jen is going to walk us through. And we also have kicked off earnings season. And so I'll be giving you a little bit of a rundown on what that is, what's happening, why you care. But let's begin with this CPI numbers, Jen, because that's obviously like a huge deal right now.
Yeah. And by the way, guys, we're piloting names for this little series. We thought we might try calling it asset class, like a master class and stuff. But if you guys have any brilliant ideas on what we should freaking call this thing, please let us know. But yeah, so yesterday, Kristen, thank you for that lovely introduction. Yesterday, we had arguably the second most important data release that we get each month in terms of economic data that we get from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, called the CPI. That's the Consumer Price Index. And that is a measure of inflation. What is inflation? It's how quickly prices are rising. And so when we get this number, a bunch of economists will do the exact same thing that they did for the non-farm payrolls report that we talked about last week. Everyone's going to say, okay, what do we think this number is going to be? Everyone publishes their estimates of what the likely consensus number is. And when the number is actually released, what the market really cares about is it at, lower than, or higher than what was expected? Because again, the theory is that markets are efficient and whatever the actual number is currently consensus is already priced in.
Which, keep that in mind. That's a theme that we're going to see later with the equities as well. So keep that in mind.
That's exactly right. So, okay. The number was higher than expected. So the headline CPI number, which is like everything, they take over 200 categories and package them into like 8 different buckets, that was up 0.4% to 3.5%. And remember, that's a year-on-year inflation number. The core CPI, which is what the Fed really looks at, that's the number we care about the most because it strips out food prices and energy prices, not because those don't impact how much inflation there is in the markets, but because they're so volatile. That was up also 0.4%. Although, if you look at it, it was 0.359 unrounded. So like, that's a big roundup. Okay. But the really important thing, and this was less of a factor when I was on the desk, but they've got something that everybody looks at now called super core, which also strips out rent and owner's equivalent rent. So it strips out how much it costs for you to live in your house every month. And that was up 0.65%. And those numbers, the surprise to the upside, it's always important to look at what was driving that and then try to draw your own conclusions about what that means. People don't always do that. So Kristen, do you know what the two actual drivers of the CPI being higher than expected were?
For this
particular
print? I don't know, actually, no.
Car insurance prices and medical expenses. So when you think about that, it's like, okay, but what does that actually mean? Like, does that mean that there's runaway inflation? Like, what impacts your car insurance? You got to be really thoughtful about these things. So there's always more to it than just the headline number. But the market really tends to react to what do you see printed on the screen? And again, side note, the fact that all of these numbers are stripped out these ways also speaks to the fact that what the Fed is looking at, it has very little to do with what the average person is seeing as the impact on their wallet, right? If you're taking out food and gas prices, that's like where most people have to spend their money every month and then rent. So like those are the things that are impacting the average consumer. There was a great Bloomberg op-ed that I read where they created their own, I forget what they called it, like consumer core of what like the average person cares about. And that graph is through the roof.
Yeah, well, I was going to say last week when we were talking non-farm payrolls, one of the things that was interesting that came out of that, the non-farm payrolls, like they were great, but it was like mostly like part-time jobs, which is actually like not that
temp
great.
Temp workers.
It's like, Mm-hmm. Yeah, temp workers. So it's like, is this actually maybe a bad thing? Even though it looks great, it's like, is this maybe not great? Because like people need to like get extra jobs so they can afford to pay for all this stuff.
Right, like, exactly. I don't know. Exactly.
So anyway.
So we talked about this last week, but just to refresh, the Fed has a dual mandate, right? They need to promote employment and they need to control inflation. And all of the monetary policy that we have been seeing over the past 2 years has been aimed at really controlling the latter because inflation has been the biggest problem in terms of that dual mandate. And so upon seeing these numbers, the market had a really strong reaction because we'd just gotten that strong payroll report last Friday. And now we've got high inflation data, which points to, again, much lower likelihood that the Fed is going to cut this year. So I think we're now pricing in, I think it's like 1.5 cuts over the course of the whole year. And I think a lot of market participants are thinking that there's a very strong likelihood that the Fed does nothing at all. Some people are talking about a non-zero chance that they hike. That seems like a bit of a stretch right now. But I mean, hey, it's always conceivable. But what does this mean for in terms of what actually happened in the markets? So the interest rate market reacted most strongly by bear flattening. And what does that mean? It means that the differential between short end rates and long end rates narrowed with the move being led.
Yeah. Short end meaning like
everything in the front end. Exactly. Yeah. So everything from 3 month rates, 1 year rates, 2 year rates, et cetera, versus 10 year and 30 year rates.
Yeah.
So the front end of the curve sold off, meaning those rates went up relative to the long end. Okay. Mm-hmm. But the whole market sold off, meaning all rates went higher, but there was a tightening in that spread between short end and long end rates. If this is the front end of the curve, this sold off relative to the long end of the curve, and the curve, that's what bear flattening looks like. So the curve bear flattened, but it was also a 10-year auction day. So the whole market's selling off, rates are rising all the way across the curve. The 10-year point sold off by like 15 or 16 basis points, and then there was a 10-year auction.
So when you say their 10-year auction, right, the government is auctioning
the
off,
U.S. Like Treasury
selling.
The U.S. Treasury is auctioning
10-year
off 10-year bonds
to fund the U.S. government. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Absolutely.
And then the market, meaning like all these market participants need to come in and buy those bonds.
That's exactly
like this
right.
Is a, yeah.
And so since rates were selling off, you would think that, okay, great. This is awesome. I get to buy these bonds much cheaper at higher yields than I would have gotten to buy them earlier in the day. This is awesome, right? Well, when an auction happens, they happen at 1 p.m., everyone has a price that they expect those bonds to get auctioned off at, right? And that is where the when issued 10-year note is trading going into the auction. And if demand is higher than expected, and there are more participants who want bonds at richer levels, meaning lower yields, and the auction ends up coming at a lower yield than the market was anticipating going in, it said that the auction came through. If the bonds are auctioned off exactly where they were trading going into 1 p.m., it said that the auction stopped on the screws. And if the bonds were issued at cheaper levels, meaning higher yields than where they were trading at 1 p.m., the auction is said to have tailed. The 10-year auction tailed by 3 basis points. That is a huge tail on a 10-year auction. So if we're talking like 100 million 10-year notes, you got those bonds $240,000 cheaper than you would have paid for them at 1 p.m. based on where the market was trading. So that's a big deal. Yeah. So there was a big tail on the 10-year auction. And so what's happening now? We're seeing yield-based buyers come in and buying corporate credit. And corporate credit spreads, they're not trading at the all-time tights, but they are trading at very tight levels relative to where we are in the monetary.
Like, again, corporate credit, we were looking at actual companies issuing their own bonds. So it's the actual companies themselves.
So corporate bonds, which are comprised of the risk-free rate, which is where U.S. Treasuries are trading, and then a credit spread on top of those, are trading at very tight spread levels, not because everyone has a view on the strength of corporate credit being so high, but because yields have gotten so high that yield-based buyers are coming in and buying these bonds on an outright basis rather than selling treasuries against them. And that's bringing credit spreads in very tight. But what's interesting is if you're in a higher interest rate environment, it's theoretically more difficult for highly leveraged companies to borrow. So there's a little bit of a divergence between the strength in the credit market and then what we saw happen in the equities market.
So if you think about what is the all-in rate that a company, if they're issuing bonds, is going to have to pay, it's going to be comprised of the risk-free rate because we assume that mm-hmm. the U.S. doesn't default. And then there is the individual credit spread. So the individual credit spread is what you as an investor are getting compensated for the potential risk that that individual company is going to default. So that's the, when you say that the credit spreads are tight, it means that they're lower or they're tighter, like they're correct. Narrower, they're not yep. as expensive. And that was the point.
No, they making. Are. So again, well, it's not as expensive for the company. It's more expensive for the company. Buyer. For the
yes,
buyer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry, for the company to issue. Yes, yes. I was mm-hmm. thinking like the company, like issuing, because that was sort of on the origination
side. And I think from the investor standpoint,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Kristen's absolutely right. And so what happened in the equity markets as a result of all of this data is that initially equities got crushed. And the reason was that all these highly leveraged companies that do have risk with their ability to fund themselves in the future. Now, Kristen, last week you started talking mm-hmm. about, oh, well, I'm going to have to apply these higher rates to my discounted cash flow models, and I'm going to have to apply a higher rate to my weighted average cost of capital. You also have to think about, okay, if I need to go back into the market and refund my company,
that's
it's going to be more
it, yeah,
expensive
yeah.
for me to do so.
Right.
So this
yeah,
is
yeah.
why those is companies got hit yesterday initially. However,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
along the lines of what Guy Adami said when he came on our podcast, we aired that episode last week, the equity markets only ended the day down 1%. And mm-hmm. the reality is because like he said, I think to some extent, every single pullback is just an opportunity to buy for a lot of investors.
Yeah, there's so much stuff to talk about here. Okay, so we are now, as Jen said, we're getting into this whole thing called earnings season. So mm-hmm. if you think about a year, companies have to report their earnings every year. Different companies have different fiscal year ends. You have some companies that do December 31st. That is the most common. But then you have other companies that are all over the place. Like Tapestry is, you know, June 30th. You have NVIDIA is January 28th. So it can be all over the place. The majority of companies are 12/31, which means that you not only have to report your annual earnings, you also have to report three more times during the year if you're in the US. So you report every quarter. So that would mean March 31st, June 31st, June 30th, and September 30th. So March 31st just happened. Today is April 11th. By the way, it's my daughter's birthday. Yay. But
well,
it is
birthday.
April 11th. Thanks. And so the companies have all closed their books. And now they're sort of leading into this earnings season. So they're going to actually tell the market how they did. And as you said, a big thing is how did they do relative to expectations? And so I wanted to actually dial in a little bit, like where did these expectations come from? So mm-hmm. you have all these research analysts. These are the sell side research analysts. So at JP Morgan, at Goldman, at Bank of America, they are looking at individual companies. And I think that this is a really interesting point because last week when we talked about non-farm payrolls, it was like, oh my God, like, you know, the market's doing great. Buy equities. And yes, you should buy equities as a whole on a macro standpoint, but like individual companies, it's mm-hmm. going to be a little different, right? Mm-hmm. So as you think about like, how does the information you're getting about the market impact earnings? Well, it depends. So if you have a company like Delta, so Delta actually announced earnings yesterday. Well, you could say, okay, non-farm payrolls were great. The market's doing great. People have jobs. People can afford to travel. Well, now you expect maybe Delta's going to have a great earnings, you know, release because they actually are going to be selling more in the future or they sold more in this quarter. So that actually, I do think that analysts revised upward after the non-farm payrolls report last week. But again, it's going to depend company to company. So you take a
company
like,
fuel prices mm-hmm. are really going to impact Delta, right?
Because Yes, exactly. So we'll get to that in one sec. So So as we think about, but like you could have a different company. So I'm going to use Hermes just because I literally just listened to a podcast episode on Hermes, like the 3-hour history of the company. But you think about them, they have these Birkin bags. You literally can't buy some of the products that they put out there, even right. if you wanted to. So mm-hmm. it's potentially a lot more inelastic. They only have so much supply that they can do, and that's the limiting factor. So having more buyers and more people that can buy their products, by the way, it's also not the like super elite. They're selling to the rich of the rich of the rich. So that is much more inelastic. So a mm-hmm. good non-farm payrolls report probably doesn't mean shit for their top line.
Right. They can just raise prices whenever they want. And,
mm-hmm. Exactly.
And people will pay it.
Exactly. Now, again, like you're sitting there, you're the Delta analyst, you're trying to figure out, okay, like what is their earnings going to look like? Well, now as we start to go down, now you think about the costs. And so as you mm-hmm. said, Jen, yeah, fuel is a huge input. So what is the price of gas or whatever they're putting into their jet fuels or whatever? And
right.
what's going on in the Middle East? And in obviously the Ukraine situation, like these wars internationally, that's a huge part of it. So again, as you're looking at the cost, maybe that's a big component, but it also depends on like, well, how much are they hedged? How long are they hedged for? Right. There's these, all these little nuances for each individual company. Like one airline could look very different from another airline. And so these are the things that those research
analysts are diving into. Do you have Boeing planes?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Do you have Boeing planes? Good thing. Yeah. That would not be great. And so again, as we think about different companies, right, in terms of how much leverage they have, how much have they borrowed? And the amount that if you have a company like Apple, they have shit tons of cash. They don't need to borrow. They borrow because they got money for free. So they have so much cash, they don't know what to do with it. And if anything, honestly, higher rates might even help them because it means that they're investing their cash. They're going to be getting a higher return. So that could even be a good thing for some companies. However, companies that were maybe previously owned by a private equity firm and had gone public, they have higher levels of debt and are potentially having that come due. That could be a huge problem. So again, the point that I want to make is that each individual company is going to have its own idiosyncrasies, if you will, and the research analysts really know the individual companies and have expectations. Now, what is consensus earnings? So consensus is literally the median of what does Bank of America think? What does JP Morgan think? What does Citi think? You get the median. That is your consensus. And Delta actually yesterday announced, I think the consensus number was expected to have 36 cents was the median EPS estimate for Q1. So the first quarter in 2024. And they came out ahead. They were at 45 cents. So that's actually great, right? That should be a huge boon. But then, of course, we have a CPI number, and that was obviously slightly problematic on the inflation side. But the other thing to keep aware is, again, as we're getting into earnings season, I was talking about, we're going to have company after company after company start to announce earnings. So this week, yesterday was Delta was the big names. Tomorrow, it's going to be JP Morgan. It is Citi. It is Wells Fargo. I think BlackRock. So you have a lot of these financial institutions. Now, from them, it's funny because, again, like this is where knowing the individual nuances of the particular company, like higher rates is actually good for banks because like they lend, they get higher rates. So it's a slightly different thing if you are a bank.
And actually, well, remember, their net interest margin is actually what matters the most. So it's not just the outright level of rates, but the shape of the curve is really important because they lend longer term and they borrow very short term. So an inverted yield curve is not good for them.
Ooh, interesting. So yeah, again, I am not a FIG expert. I think it was Anish. We talked to him a while back and he was saying like, if you work in FIG, it's like you get a tattoo on your face. It like financial institutions, like that is a very specific industry, but still, I mean, if you understand these general principles, it all kind of makes sense. You can sort of logic your way through. But Jamie Dimon actually, who's the CEO of JP Morgan, right? The largest bank in the world, but he is, I feel like, the go-to person that people look to for kind of just like words of wisdom on most things. And he put out the most intense shareholder letter. It sort of reminds me of the Warren Buffett shareholder letter that he likes to put out. And he kind of goes through just like the state of the world. Like it is, you should look at this thing. So we're going to put this in the show notes because I do think it's actually very interesting.
This is required reading. Every time Jamie Dimon writes something, if you are in the markets or if you're interested in corporate advisory, you should be reading that letter.
Yeah. And so there was a few interesting points that he made. First of all, the beginning of it is quite dark. It's basically, let me just read the first like sentence. It is, 2023 was yet another year of significant challenges, from the terrible ongoing war and violence in the Middle East and Ukraine to mounting terrorist activity to growing geopolitical tensions. I mean, it's like this whole thing is just like warning, warning, warning. And then it kind of goes on. And it's like, but we did great. You know, we've had, and they are. I mean, like JP Morgan, they bought, you know, First Republic. Anyway, it kind of goes through their earnings and everything, but then also the challenges facing America, all those kind of fun stuff. One of the things that he said that was interesting, and this was before the CPI report, but he was like, everyone expects the Fed is just going to cut rates. He's like, I don't have a strong view either way. We could see rates of 8%, right? It could keep going up. It could be down to 2%. Like, I don't know. And when someone who is looked to be like probably the best person to make any kind of prediction on this, and he's like, I have no freaking clue. I mean, that's actually kind of news in and of itself. The other thing he said, which was interesting, was the fact that the public equity markets are getting smaller. And actually, let me look up the exact number because it was a very interesting data point. So in 1996, there was 7,300 US public companies, and now there is only 4,300. So the total number has shrunk dramatically. And not only is it because you have all these you know, private companies that are just waiting longer and longer to go public. But yeah. you also have private equity firms that are buying public companies, right, taking them private. And the other kind of factor is like everyone and their mother is told, like, just put your money into passive funds that are buying equities. And so, you know, when you were talking about how like, oh, equities only sold off 1%, it's kind of like, well, supply and demand. Like, there's a lot of demand for equities, right? There's a lot of money going in and there's not as much supply. So anyway, it was a really interesting point. And I actually heard other people talk about sort of the just, I guess, advice to put money in a passive ETF. Like, yes, that's obviously good. But the problem is then you just have a lot of money chasing things and you don't have the actual sort of like finding the correct price of things. Like correct. The ability to short actually is good. Putting downward pressure on companies that like have no business, you know, continuing. It's like the GameStops, right? There's no business for them trading at the peak price that they were at. Like that was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So the amount of cash that's just going into equities long, passively not being managed is actually potentially problematic because you're not getting the market dynamics to find real prices. Anyway, we're way beyond the time we wanted to spend on this. So that's I'm going to shut up for 1 second because there was one other thing that we wanted to talk about. Last week, we had talked about the unwritten rules for succeeding on Wall Street. And actually, these are really, I think, rules to sort of succeed in life. I don't care if you're working for somebody else, if you're working for yourself. Like these are just sort of general good things to do. And someone gave us the feedback. They were like, F that, you know? And we were like, okay.
Like they were like, I wouldn't just blindly chase greed. And we were like, rule number six was like, be ethical, be humble, and be kind. Like, I don't know what crazy thing. This was such a stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. And so it got us talking, Jen and I, as much as we like the markets, we also like do have other interests. And so we, as moms of kids, like one of the things that has been a big thing that I've been reading again in like the other part of my life, which is like the parenting part. And there was this book that came out recently talking about how there's been this huge push towards gentle parenting and towards, you know, a bigger emphasis on like being appreciative of your kids' feelings and all that kind of stuff. And the result is that you end up with kids that actually are having a lot more anxiety. They're not functioning as well. And it was interesting because it's one of these things that like we are not letting kids fail. We're not letting kids do something and do it poorly and then watch as they sort of pick themselves back up and succeed. We're constantly holding their hand. And I also think that this sort of translates like, unfortunately, you know, how kids grow up, it's like practice for being an adult. And if as a kid, you're not, you know, you're constantly having people fix problems for you and you're not seeing like how life is in the real world, that like you're going to have to take initiative and you are going to have to fix things on your own, that can be problematic. And so I do think that as people are entering the real world, a lesson is that at the end of the day, like the universe owes you nothing, right? You need to persevere because you know the value that you bring to the table and you can actually succeed. The universe doesn't owe that to you. You have to fight for it. And I think that it's one of these things that, again, if you're going into an environment and the view is, well, I didn't get this thing. Oh, like, you know, the world has ended. No, try again. Like, keep going, persevere.
We're big believers in the value of building resilience. And here's the thing, when you think about your approach to parenting, and I'm not saying that gentle parenting is wrong. I'm not a parenting expert whatsoever, but I am a big believer in the beauty of a skinned knee in lieu of a broken leg. And we had one of our unwritten rules was never make the same mistake twice. One of the questions we got was like, never twice? Like what about three times? You know, and it's like, listen, your mistakes can be a gift if you have the ability to learn from them. But if somebody's going to catch you every time you trip and you never get that skinned knee, you're going to learn that it's okay to trip because there's something soft that you're going to land on. The lesson needs to be there's going to be a hard landing, and better to learn that when the stakes are low than when the stakes are extremely high. Because if in your job, in your professional life, and in your personal life, by the way, you don't learn that there are consequences to your actions and you don't learn that failure has consequences, then you're just going to continue failing, right? Like you're setting yourself up for failure because you've been taught that that begets the outcome that you desire. Yeah. So
it's like my kids, they're like, great. My kid is constantly climbing up the stairs. I don't want her to fall down the stairs, but I was talking to a friend. They're like, we never baby-proof the stairs because if they go up and they fall down once, they're like,
I'm not saying either strategy is right. I baby-proof the stairs, like, you know, but I think all of this is actually a really great setup for the episode that we're going to be airing on Saturday. We interviewed a woman named Deborah Smith, who is the CEO of a boutique investment bank specializing in real estate advisory. And one of the things I thought she said that was wonderful, I think Kristen, I think you were the one who asked her, What gave you the confidence to just start an investment bank on your own when you had three kids under five, by the way? Yeah. And she was like, I didn't think about it. I just did it. Right?
Yeah.
And had she been so worried about making mistakes, she would have been paralyzed into inaction and never have gone and done it. Mm-hmm. And instead she was like, if I made a mistake, I was going to learn from it. Right? And, you know, I released that story the other day about what it was like working at Lehman Brothers. And people are like, oh, I'm so sorry you went through that. But listen, either it was a great experience or it was a great lesson. If it wasn't a great experience, then you got to learn something from it. And so anyways, I'm really excited to release Deborah's episode this weekend. It's going to scratch the itch for so many people who want to learn about commercial real estate, about real estate investing, even though that's obviously not what she does. We do touch on it, and about real estate banking. So we're going to wrap this up. Thank you guys so much for listening to Tentatively Called Asset Class. And,
send us your ideas at questions at Wall Street Skinny if you have any better options.
Thank you guys. All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.